my name is Mike Smith. The topic that I'm going to be talking about, or that I hope we will be talking about, is South Africa. And what I'm interested in about South Africa is efforts, activities in the United States to have some impact on South Africa. That there were these efforts through the church, there were efforts organized in other forums to try to affect South Africa, and there were efforts to try to influence our government so as to have some kind of impact on South Africa. So that is what I would like to focus on today. This session is part of a general topic that I'm working on this week, and that general topic is democracy and foreign policy. And my sense is, what I'm interested in is the way that the people have some impact on the foreign policy of the country. As I've suggested in what I just said, in the case of South Africa, it's a little bit special because it's not just the people trying to influence the government's policy, but it's the people themselves directly or through other kinds of institutions trying to influence South Africa. So that, it seems to me, goes beyond the normal instance where we try to get the government to do something different. I am interested in this topic both because of a fairly long-term interest in South Africa and because it is the example. When political scientists talk about democracy and foreign policy, it is often the example they can come up with of a case where there was a government policy and a lot of people said, we're not satisfied with this policy, it should be something different. And from public pressure, the policy was changed. And I'm thinking particularly of the sanctions that were enacted in 1986, that the Reagan administration had taken a particular stance toward South Africa. The Reagan administration was opposed to having sanctions enacted. Congress passed sanctions over the veto, and I think at least in part in response to widespread public concern about South Africa. So this is very much a case, and if you can think of other similar cases, I would be delighted to hear those other cases where there was significant or substantial public interest and public pressure that seemed to lead to a change in government policy. The public made up its mind, or a significant portion of the public made up its mind, and the government reacted to that or responded to that when it was initially inclined to do something else. And I think those kinds of cases are pretty rare. And especially in foreign policy, they're pretty rare. Now, it seemed like the place to begin in talking about South Africa is to talk about the policy that so many people found appalling in South Africa, and that's apartheid. So I want to write that on the board and then ask you what you know about that and what you think about that. What do you know about apartheid? What was or what is apartheid?
Well, it was just as I understood it from all the news coverage I've seen, I've never actually seen a definition of apartheid, but it was just a system of separation between the races in South Africa. And I'm not sure that there's probably something more to it. If you find the actual definition, maybe it's a separation within the government or only separation within the public places, but it's some broad separation between the races.
Okay, it is about separation of the races, and I think there's an implicit element that says some races are better than others, although at times the South Africans would deny that they were taking that position.
And legal separation.
Okay, it's a legal separation. Whites are entitled to be in certain places. Blacks are entitled to be in other places. Beyond that, do you know more about it? I mean, what that meant was if you were in very often in public areas, there would be signs, whites only, coloreds only, to indicate who was entitled to be there.
I also understand that it's not just whites versus blacks, but there's a number of other groups as well, and they get put into different categories also. For example, there's a large Indian group.
Okay, there were four major categories, and that would be the whites, the coloreds, the Asians, and the Bantus, the black African peoples. And then within each of those, you have several different tribal groups among the Bantu people, and the Boers would be one group of whites. And in fact, tended to be the dominant, I'm not sure numerically that they outnumber other whites, but they tended to be the dominant group. These were the descendants of the Dutch settlers several centuries ago who saw themselves as very much an African tribe. They were a white African tribe, that's how they saw themselves, and they tended to dominate politics, at least in the last 40 or 50 years. They dominated politics, and they very much set up the system of apartheid. What also goes along with this was land ownership rights. Not only, you know, there were places where whites belonged and places where colors belonged. Most of the land belonged to the whites. The whites decided what the laws would be, and the laws were that they got something like 87% of the land. They were maybe 1/6 of the population, but claimed as theirs 80-some percent of the land. And then the other groups got little chunks. Do you have any other images of apartheid? Any other sense of what it was about?
One thing I don't know is, did they think that the separation was separate but equal? Or did they define it as that, or was it just separate?
It was just separate at, I'm not well informed on the history of the development of apartheid. My sense is that it changed from one decade to another decade. At one point they talked about, and they had a policy of setting up homelands. They would set, you know, this chunk of land aside for the Zulus, or that chunk of land aside for the Xhosa people or the Tswana people. And so the notion was, in some sense, all the Xhosa came from that land, although in fact historically they did not. The theory was they all came from that land and they all should go back to that land. And so it's like having reservations. It was a policy similar to having reservations. And then, theoretically, anyone who was Zulu would have a Zulu passport and would be a citizen of this Zulu enclave, and then just be permitted because, you know, the South Africans had let them in to South Africa. And so they did. And this isn't shown on the map, and I'm not sure where all the homelands were. Botswana is this country, and the Tswana homeland, or at least a Tswana homeland, was up in this general area, as they tried to define where the Tswana people belonged.
But it wasn't two separate societies. The blacks came into the white society and didn't work, and then had to go back by nightfall.
Yeah, and so what happened in the major cities was much of the major city would be white. There might be a colored area or an Asian area. Generally, there would be sort of suburban area, in a sense, suburban areas, shanty towns or something outside the city where blacks were allowed to live, and then they come into the city and then go back at night to where they lived. Or sometimes they'd have permission. If you were a maid in a house or something, you might have permission to stay at that white residence. But these are all some of the features of apartheid. The general reaction, I think, as people learned about what apartheid was that they thought it was a bad system. And I'm a little bit inclined to ask you about your reactions. Does this seem like an evil system that was constructed there?
I think that the outcome of it, you know, and late 80s was certainly evil. Maybe there was a different intent early on, you know, about, you know, setting up homelands for certain, you know, ethnic groups. That in itself doesn't seem so bad. I think maybe it did not start out so bad, but it became so bad.
Okay. Other thoughts? I mean, my sense is, and I have some things to show you in a moment, my sense is that public awareness and American awareness grew gradually, and so we were tremendously aware when apartheid was first instituted, and then as we learned more about it, the public became more concerned or more alarmed about it.
I think more of us going through the civil rights movement brought
heightened awareness of other countries too.
I think that's absolutely true. That maybe in the 1950s we were not sensitive on these kinds of issues, and beginning in the 1960s, at least some people were sensitive. And they looked at South Africa and they said, that's appalling. And we tried to do away with separate restrooms and separate facilities in our country, and here's a place that's going even farther than anything we ever tried to do. So. Well, what I want to do then for some time here is to look at a chronology of events in South Africa. And as I said when I started, my primary interest here is efforts by groups in the United States to do something about South Africa and policies in South Africa. And as I said, it takes two forms. One kind of thing that happened is attempts to get our government to change its policy, and the other kind of thing is working through other sorts of groups. And I'd like to give an example which isn't on, up here because it's a minor example. In 1970, I heard a labor organizer speak. This fellow worked in a labor union that worked for Polaroid, and he talked about how Polaroid, the workers at Polaroid became upset because they found that the passbooks that were used in South Africa, that they were using photographs using film made by Polaroid, and they said, we want to stop doing this, that we are aiding and abetting this government and we want to stop doing this, and they pressured Polaroid to stop doing this. It's a minor kind of action that occurred, but it's one of the things that happened over the course of several decades. Now, I was hoping that you would yourselves know about some things. We have a smaller crowd than I had thought we might have. But as I go along, if you're aware of actions, of activities intended to affect South Africa, I'd like you to talk about those sorts of things. And two, as we look through this, if you have questions, raise those questions. This chronology begins, can you see this? Where you are? It begins in 1948. In 1948, the Boer Party, the Afrikaner Party, or an Afrikaner Party, won control of the government. And that party has controlled the government ever since. Now, voting in elections has, until the 1980s, was restricted to whites only. Whites were the only ones who had any political power. And so it was a question of what faction among the whites would be dominant. And the two major groups among the whites were the Boers or the Afrikaners, these descendants of the Dutch settlers, and then the other segment was the English. And so there was there were political struggles between the Dutch and the English, between the Boers and the English. Well, this party won in 1948, and they really are the architects of the policy of apartheid that they put in place. Two important elements of that policy of apartheid were enacted in 1950. The Group Areas Act, which said who could live where, what land belonged to what group. And subsequently, that will be amended somewhat, but that started at that time. And the other is the Population Registration Act, which said that everybody had to register what racial group they were a part of. Were you Dutch? Were you English? Were you colored, which was a mixed race kind of person? Were you Bantu, and if you were Bantu, what tribe did you belong to? As time passed, the authorities in South Africa got very insistent in looking at people's ancestry. And periodically there would be prominent white persons where it was discovered that the great-grandfather, great-grandmother wasn't white, and then they weren't white any longer. They were now a colored person, and they couldn't live where they lived, and their family might have to move to a colored area. And it had tremendous personal consequences when these kinds of things were found out. But they became very systematic at looking at people's ancestry and determining who you were, where you belonged. In 1952, in South Africa, there was a public protest against apartheid. As in 1951-52, the government of South Africa was instituting apartheid, the people of South Africa began to complain about it and oppose it. We jump ahead to 1960. In, I believe, the late 1950s, the PASS laws were enacted. Do you know what they were?
They had to carry passes and show where they worked and what their ancestry was and all sorts of things, and they could be asked to see that pass at any time.
The police at any time could stop a person, and of course normally they stopped colored people or people who appeared to be colored or black. They didn't tend to stop whites, but you were supposed to carry on your person these documents that identified who you were, what your ancestry, what your racial background was, and also identified where you belonged, so that a black who worked in Johannesburg would need to have papers that said they were permitted and when they were permitted to be in Johannesburg and where they could travel. And so if the police found you in a white area and you were non-white, you needed to be able to document that you belonged there. And if you couldn't do that, they'd take you off to jail. And they might take you off to jail anyway if you were difficult. But the police had great power and they enforced these laws rather strictly. And there was then a protest in 1960. And it's my sense that this is one of the first times Americans really became aware of South Africa was the Sharpeville protest. And what happened at Sharpeville, there were people protesting the PASS laws and the police fired into the crowd and killed a number of demonstrators. And so this was came to be known as the Sharpeville Massacre. Do you recall that? Does that ring a bell? I talked to someone in Britain and he said that in Britain this was really the beginning of the concern and opposition in Britain to South Africa. But you have a similar recollection. At the same time, two groups that were black organizations for blacks to try to demand equal rights and fair rights for them were banned. The ANC, the group that Nelson Mandela's associated with, the group that has been unbanned and become an active participant in politics, and the PAC, the Pan-African Congress. And the PAC was a group that said the ANC isn't aggressive enough and militant enough, so we're going to sort of do them one better. And the South African government just said, we don't want either one of you around, and outlawed both organizations, both the ANC and the PAC in 1960. I'd like to skip ahead then to 1969. In 1969, the United States made an assessment, this is when Nixon is president, made an assessment of what our policy towards South Africa ought to be. The National Security Council debated this and came to a conclusion, and the conclusion was South Africa is important, that it has important resources, that it is in a strategically important location, and so we are concerned, the United States was concerned about South Africa. We would like to have a stable ally in South Africa, and we regarded the white government, even though it was clearly a minority government, as a potential ally. They were non-communist, they were pro-West, they seemed to be relatively stable, they were industrially advanced, and so we took on a policy of being pro-South Africa. In the turmoil of Africa, they seemed to be a bastion of at least some values that we embraced. And that policy that was decided in 1969 really is the policy that the United States follows for a long time after that, with the possible when Jimmy Carter was president, you could say that there was some change in the policy. Carter was more explicitly critical of South Africa than Nixon or Ford had been or than Reagan chose to be. But that generally was our policy from 1969 up until the sanctions vote in Congress. I feel like if you have any questions or comments, ask them or jump in. And really from this point on, this is where I begin to become aware in a larger way of South Africa at this time, and it is from this point on that there are activities going on in the United States. 1976, then, there's a protest in Soweto, Southwest Township, an area, black area outside Johannesburg. School children are upset about what's happening in their schools. If you came to the program, I think Sunday night, there was some talk about, was it Sunday night or Saturday night, I'm not sure, some talk about the what happened in, at that time. The government of South Africa estimated that there were 600 people killed, many of them school children or young persons. Other authorities say that they think the numbers are a lot higher than that, but a large number of people were killed in response to this protest in South Africa. 1977 then, Steve Biko, do you recall Steve Biko? A black political leader was arrested and beaten and died in police custody. The United Nations took a stance, adopted an arms embargo. They saw South Africa as a dangerous country and said no one should sell arms to South Africa. And the Lutheran World Federation took a stance. I don't know the history of those developments, but the Lutherans began to say this is something we should take seriously. And I would suggest that in some ways the Lutheran Church, and there were other churches in the United States and elsewhere that were also taking stances at this point, they were maybe a little bit ahead of the governments in decrying what was going on in South Africa. Also, the Sullivan Principles were announced in 1977. Do those ring a bell? The Sullivan Principles, there was a minister in the United States, Leon Sullivan, who said that we ought to, who said that there are a lot of American corporations operating in South Africa. And the labor conditions are very bad. One of the laws, one of the elements of apartheid in South Africa was the job bar. And the jobs bar said that there could be no non-white person who was a superior to a white person. In any industry, in any business, the whites always had to be the bosses and in charge, and the blacks or the non-whites had to be subordinates. It was against the law to make a black person a foreman or a supervisor and have a white person reporting to them. Now what went along with that was the wages for the whites were much better than the wages for the non-whites. But it, by law, you could not have a non-white supervising a white. And what Sullivan said was, well, we have American corporations operating there. And they operate, you know, when General Motors or Ford operates in Detroit, they treat their white and black workers the same. And they could do the same thing in South Africa. So he said American corporations ought to be asked to pressure the government of South Africa to change its employment policies, and they ought to be pressured to, as much as they can themselves, change their own employment policies. They can raise wages. They can treat black workers better. They can give black workers, if they can't give black workers jobs higher than white workers, they can give black workers comparable jobs and pay them better wages. And so he announced his principles and called on U.S. corporations operating in South Africa to make these kinds of adjustments. And there was, now I'm not sure how quickly this happens, but there was a gradual giving in. U.S. corporations began to say, you're right, we ought to do that, and to more or less comply with the Sullivan Principles. The next step, we jump into the 1980s. The next step here that I mention is that the World Alliance of Reformed Churches declared apartheid a theological heresy. The significance of that is that the Church of the Boers, the Church of the Afrikaners, is the Dutch Reformed Church. And the Dutch Reformed Church was then a part of this World Alliance of Reformed Churches. So when this global body of which they are a part says apartheid is wrong, then that is an important statement. The position of the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa had been that apartheid was fine. They said there's nothing wrong with apartheid. And so when this larger body of which they are a part says, no, you're wrong, it isn't all right, then that that was a message to the people of South Africa that there was something wrong about their government.
Yeah, I'm going to jump back for just a second here. When it says the UN Security Council adopts an arms embargo, does that mean many countries or just the countries on the Security Council?
That means
just completely arms embargo?
My impression is that this was a voluntary arms embargo, but that the Security Council said to the countries of the world, you should not sell arms to South Africa.
Okay, were other countries going along with that? I'm assuming the United States went along with it and didn't.
By and large. I think you had a little bit the same kind of thing you had with Iraq. Okay. That there was a little bit of cheating, a little bit of non-compliance. I believe the French went ahead and sold weapons.
The Israelis have been in cahoots with South Africa for years and years and years, and my guess is that they kept up with arms, because I think one or the other was helping the other develop the bomb.
There have for a long time been allegations that Israel and South Africa worked together, and we had South Africa, I think within the last year, admitted that they had the bomb. That they had always in the past denied it. There was always just rumor that they had the bomb, but they admitted, de Klerk admitted very recently that in fact they had the bomb, but they didn't have it any longer, that they had dismantled it and destroyed it. And I don't believe that they were forthcoming with all the details about what had happened, and I don't believe that he admitted the Israeli connection, but that's what many people thought had occurred, was a collaboration between Israel and South Africa. But part of what South Africa did in response to this situation, South Africa felt very embattled. The white government in South Africa said, you know, not only are the countries that are hostile toward us, since we are anti-communist, not only are the communist countries hostile, not only are many black African countries hostile, but are the countries that should be our friends, the Western capitalist countries, are turning hostile toward us.
A theory that I've always had with that is that, you know, when everyone stops sending arms and other products, I'll just say, to South Africa, it made South Africa a very self-reliant country. Because when they stopped sending Kodak film, they developed themselves. When they stopped sending arms, they developed themselves. And now South Africa, you know, embargo, big deal. You know, they can do it themselves.
That's what happened. They developed their own arms industry. If you won't sell us weapons, we will develop our own weapons. There are similar developments that come along. But they did turn in on themselves, and they say, since no one else will help us, we have to do it ourselves.
When was the banning of the Kruger end? When was that?
I can't recall. That was mentioned the other night, and I said, oh, yes, but I don't...
I remember when that happened, but I can't put the date on it at all. I have no idea.
Yeah, what had happened sometime during the 1980s was that one of South Africa's export items is gold, and they started minting Krugerrands when we went on a gold standard, and everybody was saying, you can't trust the economy, and so buy gold, and they started creating Krugerrands. And I think shortly after that, Canada created the maple leaf as their gold coin. But there was then a movement in the United States, let's boycott the Krugerrands, let's not buy any of these Krugerrands because it just supports the government of South Africa. Another major export item is diamonds. They have a lot of minerals, and those are things that they have historically tried to sell.
That's another connection with Israel, because Israel buys up all the diamonds and cuts them, and then they sell them.
And there is another interesting connection, because they, while South Africa always presented itself as very much a non-communist, anti-communist country, one of the other major producers of gold in the world is the Soviet Union. And so there were shared interests. It was in the interests of both South Africa and the Soviet Union to have high prices for gold. And so there was some sense that if they didn't directly collaborate, that they sort of informally collaborated in trying to keep the price of gold up. But it's just some of those odd things that go on in international politics. The thing at the bottom I mentioned, South Africa, by the 1980s, I think, began to recognize that they were in trouble. And in 1983, then, they said, we need to let some of these other groups into power. And so if the dominant group has been the whites, even though they a very small percentage of the total population, they said, we will share power with the Asians, the Indians, and with the coloreds. We're just not prepared to share power with the blacks. And so the status in society, it was the whites on top, there were Asians and coloreds, and I'm not really sure who would be in second place, and the blacks were on the bottom. And what the whites were saying, in a sense, was, okay, Asians, coloreds, we'll let you into power. We'll let you share power if you will help us keep the blacks down. And so this, they say, we'll create this tricameral legislature that brought together whites and coloreds and Asians and blacks in South Africa, called the United Democratic Front. So this is a South African organization, a mixed race organization that said, we're opposed to all of this. We believe in the one man, one vote principle. We want to change the politics and government of South Africa. And this was an internal organization. And the response of the UDF then is to boycott this new government that gets created. And so they boycott elections. They say, we don't want any of our people participating in these elections. We want to demonstrate that these are shams and that this is not satisfactory. There were protests and riots in the urban areas in South Africa, even though the urban areas, by and large, were supposed to be white with blacks and on the fringe. South Africa lost control of the black communities and black neighborhoods. And in the same year, 1984, the Lutheran World Federation called on the churches to oppose apartheid, to boycott goods from South Africa, to stop investing. And this is one of the major activities that went on in the 1980s, was divestiture or disinvestment. Do you recall anything about that? Yeah, it was interesting because those are two arenas where it was a very big issue. Churches, and a number of churches took steps. I know the Presbyterian Church about this time debated at their General Assembly every 3 years. They debated this issue of divestiture, and also the colleges and universities. And many of them, to the point, if you're not connected with a college or a university, I don't know, there is a publication, the Chronicle of Higher Education, that comes out once a week. If you're not connected with colleges and universities, you've probably never seen this thing and never heard of it. But college administrators read it like a Bible. Every week it comes and you have to read the latest news about what's going on in colleges and universities. They ran a permanent column on South Africa to keep track of what was happening on different campuses during the 1980s. It was, so much was happening. So on lots of college campuses and university campuses, as well as in the churches, disinvestment was going on. It was widespread policy. 1985, South Africa responds to the chaos that's emerging, declares a state of emergency, apparently was successful then by declaring a state of emergency and putting police and army units into the communities to suppress some of the violence that was occurring. At the same time, the value of the rand fell. The rand is the currency of South Africa. And as the value of the rand fell, there was a very interesting result. A lot of businesses started saying, well, we don't want to be in South Africa. It's politically unstable. So where there had been pressure, and the pressure had been going on for several years from churches and colleges and other groups to get businesses to pull out of South Africa, businesses began voluntarily pulling out of South Africa at this point for political reasons, because they felt that their investments in South Africa were unsafe, which is, on another level, fairly tragic. Because there were a lot, there are two dimensions to this. One is, there are a lot of people employed in South Africa who were losing jobs, seeing the businesses that they worked for departing. The other thing is, you suggested, this is the economic counterpart to making their own arms. If Ford or General Motors leave South Africa, there's generally someone local that buys the plant. The plant is still there. And so businesses that had been foreign-owned businesses very often were sold to local South African owners at bargain basement prices. Now, they may not be able to export what they produce, but they could still produce for the home market. So there is a changeover in economic control in South Africa at that time. 1986 is my banner year that have been leading up to. There is such awareness, I think, really growing out of these events in 84 and 85, of what was going on in South Africa. There were protests occurring in the United States, and the United States Congress got on the bandwagon. And I'm wondering if you have any recollections of that year, 1986, and what led up to Congress enacting sanctions. Do you recall that? Or is this something really that it's too long ago?
In particular that year, but I remember in Seattle a huge rally of people who gathered outside the home of the council or something from South Africa who lived in one of the neighborhoods, and they had a huge demonstration, and it was just a regular home neighborhood. Now, I don't remember if it's that year, but I do remember that event very well.
Yeah, the same kind of thing I think was happening in Washington, was protest by the South African embassy at people's homes. It was very public, and there was a lot of media coverage of the protests about South Africa. And it seemed to go on day after day, week after week. It really, there was a lot of attention paid to the protests about South Africa. Well, I'd like to stop for a minute and ask you what you think about these things. Disinvestment or divestiture had the effect of meaning people lost jobs. The protests were a way of saying that the United States could tell another country what it ought to do. One of the old tried and true principles of international relations is the internal affairs of a country are its own business. It's no one else's business. If the Chinese want to, you think of the dramatic examples, if the Chinese government is going to torture its people or arrest its democracy protesters, that's its own business. If the Soviet Union is going to mistreat its Jewish people or some other segment of its population, that's its own business. This is an old, maybe appalling principle of international politics. What do you think about this? Either the political activities or the notion about the conflict.
I feel that it was sort of an anomaly in a way. It was something that hadn't happened before, and I seriously doubt it would happen again. Now I doubt it because there's so much media out there manipulating our information. I think that the Americans ought to be up in arms about what's happening in some other places in the world. We're not. It's only if it's convenient do we get up in arms about Somalia or if we think we can win the war. But we turn our backs on other places because it's inconvenient or it's against our interests or something like that.
Like oil or
And so I really kind of wonder whether this is sort of a one and only time. I wish it would happen again in some other places.
Yeah. When I think of the way America is and the way Americans have a tendency to be, is that you might see this kind of thing happening more often. You know, we don't like the way you're doing this, and we're going to stick our noses in here, and we're going to change it whether you like. We're going to make your lives miserable until you change it. Yeah, there is some set of, some arguments say we only do that when it's convenient. But I think as time progresses more and more, and a younger generation comes along, and it's going to say no. And isn't going to follow these rules of, that's their country and let them go with it. Because now it's much more of a global community. And it's our business what's happening across the globe now.
Part of the reason I think that we hesitated to tell other countries to get involved was we were afraid on other occasions that they might do the same to us. That when we had riots like the riots in Los Angeles, that they might say, look at how bad you are, United States. We need to send in a UN observer team to Los Angeles to see what's happening in Los Angeles. And so to keep the UN out of LA or keep the UN out of Detroit, we said we won't send the UN into South Africa either.
Is right now, the United States wields so much power even in the UN, and all we have to do is continue to stop paying our dues. And
Well, we have a favored position in the UN, there's no question. Which means we can scrutinize other people and they can't scrutinize us. Yeah. Still, I think, a moral problem about that. Seems hypocritical.
Wasn't in South Africa, wasn't there also some argument saying that we shouldn't embargo for the reason that most of the unemployment would happen among the blacks? All you're doing is taking jobs away from the blacks. It's not really going to affect the upper class whites. And that there's other ways to go about protesting apartheid besides economic embargo, because all you're doing is hurting the people that you're trying to help.
That was a very, yeah, a very real argument. Yeah, who's going to suffer?
Yeah.
Bishop Tutu was visiting the United States frequently at that time and came to Seattle. And somebody asked him at that time whether he thought the embargo should happen, and he said he didn't think so.
Well, he was an outspoken leader, and so was Bosak, and I think on other occasions he spoke in favor of the embargo, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. You made it earlier. I can't put my dates on the
Yeah, he became, as I think this indicates in a year or two here, he became fairly radical mm-hmm. in what he and Bosak said in 1988. Any other thoughts on these methods? I mean, what we had was churches and colleges embracing, whether it's divestiture or whether it's the embargo, embracing the notion of increasing the economic pain, increasing the suffering in South Africa, and the primary sufferers would be the blacks. But the whites would also suffer, and did, and their standard of living fell. Well, as I say, the embargo, this motion did succeed. The Congress passed it through partly because you had Republicans joining Democrats. In order to override a presidential veto, you need two-thirds of both houses. There weren't enough Democratic votes. It was Democrats and Republicans together that said, we've got to do something. Now, they may have been appealing to different audiences. There's some suggestion that the Republicans said, we want black votes. You know, there is no, you can't vote to against sanctions and hope that you'll have blacks vote for you in the future. And so there may have been, you know, some fairly crass political motives in the votes. It's sort of like voting on gun control. There's only one right answer if you're an elected politician. And apparently that was the sentiment at that time. But the groups that did the protesting in 1985 and 1986 had done a very good job of making this issue a very prominent issue. And so the vote took place. Well, after that, we have in 1988, Tutu and Bosak saying South Africa is outlawing peaceful protest. The only thing that's left is violence. And I recall some people in this country saying that you know, this is just appalling to have these church leaders. Bosak was a colored minister who was a leader in the Dutch Reformed Church. Tutu was an Episcopalian bishop. To have them advocating violence, they thought was terrible. What is your sense? Can a political situation be so bad that it's appropriate for church leaders to call for violence, to say, you know, nonviolence has not succeeded, cannot succeed, external pressure has not succeeded. The only thing left is a violent revolution. Have they gone beyond the fringe? Is that too much to say that?
Had the government made any concessions by that time?
Well,
it
had been making some concessions during the 80s. The question that always comes up when that happens is, are they serious? Are they just doing something as a token? They're making this little step to try to buy us off and nothing more. Or are they really planning to change? I recall reading an article in The Economist. If you go back to when they created the tricameral legislature, economists said, had they done this 3 years earlier, had they done this 4 or 5 years earlier, the world would have applauded. It would have been wonderful. It would have been a sign of a spirit of reform. But when it happened, after so many things had happened previously, it was too late. It was inadequate when it happened. But they were making some kinds of changes. But the basic elements of apartheid remained in place at this time. So there was still apartheid, even though there were some changes occurring. And part of what happened with the sanctions was we said there were 5 conditions, and I don't recall the conditions. We said 4 out of 5 of these conditions must be met. If these 4 out of 5 of the conditions are met, then we will lift the sanctions. One was the release of Nelson Mandela. Mandela was the famous ANC leader who had been jailed by the government of South Africa for years. I don't recall any of the other conditions, but they all had to do with dismantling apartheid. I think one was allowing the ANC to be removing the ban on the ANC. They were political kinds of changes that needed to occur. So 1989, the Dutch Reformed Church takes the position, this is in a sense the parent body of the branch in South Africa. It says apartheid is sinful. I mean, this is getting to be terrible. The church that is the church of the Afrikaners in South Africa, the mother church, is saying what you're doing there is wrong. De Klerk, who becomes president, who's a prominent politician who becomes president, says we have to reform the system, and then takes over as president in 1989 in a shift in political power in the National Party. In 1990, he begins making real substantial changes. He's, rather than being 5 years too late, he really seems to catch up with the times. Legalized ANC and the PAC. In a surprise, he says Nelson Mandela can be released from jail. And in response, the ANC, that had some years earlier said, we have to engage in armed struggle. Nonviolence is not enough. Peaceful protest is not enough. We have to use violence to overthrow South Africa. The ANC says we are no longer going to engage in armed struggle. We can work with this government. We think we can. We will still protest and make demands, but we see a possibility of working things out without resorting to arms.
Was there any influence from England
in all of this? There was at some time, and I don't recall precisely the time. There was a time when, and it would have been earlier, but there's a time when Thatcher met with the prominent eminent persons. She met with a number of leaders of Commonwealth countries, and they impressed on her the need to take a strong stand towards South Africa.
So it wasn't just prior to de Klerk making some new...
I don't believe it was. Part of the thing here has been that there had been resentment between the Boers and the English in South Africa. The English often were the businessmen, the Boers were the farmers. The Boers saw the English as not understanding what South Africa was about. And so there, even though I'm sure there were English who voted for the National Party, there's still a sense of two rival communities. And so the South Africans would often tend to resent English influence. And of course they had fought a battle. The Boer War was about who would control South Africa, whether the Boers would or whether the English would, and of course the English won that, but then 10 years later or so gave South Africa its independence. So there's some historic antagonism and reason that the South Africans wouldn't fall over to satisfy the English. 1991 then, the laws that were the basic elements of apartheid were repealed. The Land Act, the Group Areas Act, and the Population Registration Act. And it is at that time that South Africa says we need to get together lots of different parties to see about drafting a new constitution. And that those efforts, I don't know, you may be aware, those efforts have been ongoing efforts. They've been There have been periodic interruptions, periodic kinds of troubles with those efforts, but they've been seem to be trying to do that. And the thing I think we're most aware of today is the violence between the ANC and INCADA. And what that's about, INCADA is a organization representing the Zulu people. They have not been happy. They seem to have their own relationship that they'd worked out with the government of South Africa. ANC, the INCADA people say, the ANC doesn't speak for us. We disagree with them. We want to have our own seat at the table. We want to be a participant in the negotiations. And so they tended to resent it when it seemed like the South African government and the ANC negotiated. Mandela and de Klerk got together and negotiated and worked out the future of South Africa. Buthelezi and INCADA felt like we're being left out.
How many different factions are there?
Well, these are the major ones we're aware of. I imagine there's a capacity for a lot more. You know, if you think of the Dutch and the English, you think of the coloreds who are obviously at the table, but we don't hear as much about them, and the Asians.
Minor players.
And then you have all the tribal groups. And part of Buthelezi's claim was, I'm president of a homeland, there's the KwaZulu homeland, I am the leader of the Zulu people, which is an important tribe. You have a leader of the Tswana people, you have a leader of the Xhosa people, you should have a leader of the Zulu people, and I am also the leader of INCADA. In a sense, I should have three seats at the table, because there are these three different organizations. And instead you're telling me Nelson Mandela represents me, and he really doesn't. So they have been the biggest problem, and then it is violence between ANC supporters and INCADA supporters that is the violence we've been most aware of. And there is some evidence that part of the thing you have, even though the National Party, which has been the Afrikaner Party, has been leading these changes, there are Afrikaners who reject them, who say it's a mistake. And so some of them say, we want to organize our own conservative party or some other Afrikaner party because the National Party doesn't speak for us anymore. And there are others who try to change from within the National Party and what that party's doing. And you have police and security forces in South Africa who object to what the government is doing. And some of them seem to be working with INCADA to encourage some of the violence. And in saying that, I have to say I'm a little bit hesitant. I feel like our reporting tends to be pro-ANC reporting. And you're never quite certain. I guess I tend to be suspicious. Whenever I hear reporting that makes these guys out to be the good guys and those guys out to be the bad guys, I wonder if there isn't another side to it.
Is that because of Mandela's influence?
That, probably. Mandela seems to be a saint. And so ANC gets a very positive press. I don't know. I have covered the material I wanted to cover. Do you have any thoughts about this process? Any questions or comments?
What is your feeling about the future? We have the election supposedly happening in about a year. Is that really going to happen, do you think? And do you think it's going to work?
This is a new country we just invented here. Some of the Afrikaners are saying that there ought to be a new homeland, that is an Afrikaner homeland, are saying we ought to chop this up, in a sense the same way Yugoslavia was chopped up. We ought to chop this up and we'll let people have their homelands. And we want a big one. Absolutely. And we developed the gold mines and the diamond mines. There are so many factions there, the potential for a breakdown in violence, it seems to me there's a tremendous potential.
Is there sufficient intellect to make the transition?
Well, my impression at a distance of Nelson Mandela is very favorable, and I have to say my impression of de Klerk is also very favorable. It seems like you have two men there of real vision. There are radicals in both camps. There are these conservative Afrikaners who prefer violence. You know, we want to cling to something. We may not hold the whole thing, but we want our chunk. And there are young black militants who get upset, and they get upset when their leaders get killed. The killing of what, Hani, a few weeks ago, or is that his name? Do you know this communist? There was a communist leader in South Africa who was killed a few weeks ago, and Mandela, because of his time in prison, has a tremendous reputation, but he's dealing with people who can be inflamed fairly easily, so it's a tough situation. There are these people. I guess I have the fear of assassination. Of Mandela's an old man. It seems like he could die.
Are there successors?
I'm not certain that there are. That there are people, because they need to be people of great stature. And the people who are his compatriots are also his age.
How old is Mandela again?
Well, I'm
70.
75 or something. He's in his 70s, and the fellow whose name I can't think of, who is talked about as with not the same reverence, but with a great deal of reverence, is also in his 70s. So I don't know of younger leaders out there, and younger leaders with the same stature and vision that these men seem to have. What they're trying to pull off is difficult. You're getting my pessimism. I tend to be very pessimistic about a lot of things. I'm afraid.
Is this a lot different from what happened with Rhodesia?
It's significantly different. Yeah, in several respects. The settler group in Rhodesia was only 4 or 5% of the population. So you're talking about 95% black, 5% white. You have only one or two major tribal groupings in Rhodesia. You had apparently much better relations. I talked at one point to a Malawian who talked about going into bars in Rhodesia versus going into bars in South Africa. And he said, well, I mean, you didn't have the pass laws. You didn't have apartheid in Rhodesia. It might be that the white settlers were very much better off, and there was resentment or whatever, but you didn't have that kind of oppressive system. And it was a white government for a long time, but you didn't have the oppressive system that you had in South Africa. So it was different in a lot of ways. Rhodesia is still, Zimbabwe has had its problems. It's time for us to stop. So we'll stop at this point. If you want to stay around, have any more comments or questions, we can take them up.